It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We unpack former President Donald Trump's legal battles now as the criminally indicted candidate seeks the Republican nomination to return to the White House. We examine where these investigations stand in multiple states. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ankush Kodori is a lawyer in Washington, D.C., a contributing editor for New York Magazine and a contributing writer for Politico Magazine. Ankush, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So by the numbers, former President Donald Trump facing two civil lawsuits and criminal charges in four cases. Which of these cases is the most consequential?
I think it's the Justice Department's 2020 election case, the criminal case that they filed in D.C. concerning Trump's efforts to kind of overturn the 2020 election. It's a complicated question when people kind of ask which is the most important or which is the most serious. There are a lot of different ways to sort of measure it or to try to assess that. But that's sort of where I come out based on what I think is sort of the importance of the case to the country, quite honestly, and also sort of the likelihood of a conviction and the likelihood of that conviction being sustained and potentially resulting in a term of imprisonment.
You've written about the legal risks of bringing criminal charges against a former president. What are the risks for an agency like the U.S. Department of Justice?
Well, I mean, the principal risk is that, like, they could actually lose these cases. And I think at that point, you know, they've sort of broken a seal here, which a lot of people were clamoring for. I support it myself, meaning the decision to bring criminal charges if prosecutors believe that they are appropriate. But of course, that had never happened before in our country. And if these cases sort of unravel or if there's a mistrial or an acquittal, I think an acquittal is extremely unlikely, but a mistrial is very much, I think, in the realm of possibility. It's going to look very bad for the department. It's going to look like they got out over their skis, that there was a politicized effort, that they misjudged the situation. And that's like sort of way down the line and somewhat hypothetical. But those are the sorts of things that people have been worried about and the sort of prospect that these sorts of prosecutions might become more routine.
What about these prosecutions and the timing of trials? How does that fit into the 2024 presidential campaign and what Trump is capable of doing in campaigning, but also facing these courtroom battles?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most remarkable aspect of these cases, which is that, you know, the political and legal paths, if you will, or sort of avenues, are like fully intertwined in Trump's case, right? These trials are currently scheduled across March and May, the DC case, the New York criminal case, the Florida criminal case concerning the documents at Mar-a-Lago. And those dates overlap with Republican primary dates. Those are dates that are right in the 2020 campaign season, preceding just even the nominating convention for the GOP, which will be in August. So, you know, all of this is occurring sort of simultaneously, and it all sort of heightens the risk and sort of the uncertainty surrounding it. But in terms of Trump and his approach, right, I think the simplest way to sort of understand what Trump is trying to do in terms of his legal strategy is his principal legal strategy is winning re-election, right? That is the thing that will sort of allow him to extricate himself most easily from at least the federal cases and possibly the state cases, at least while he is in office. So in order to do that, and we can get into this, I'm sure, he's sort of engaging in a bunch of delay tactics, trying to sort of throw various forms of gears in the sand, because his principal objective, I think, is to push these cases off and hope that he gets back in office.
We're talking about the indictments against former President Trump with Ankush Kodori. He's a lawyer, writer, former federal prosecutor. You can join in with your questions and comments. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ankush, Wisconsin Congressman Glenn Grothman called the FBI raid of Trump's home in August 2022 a blatant politicization of the Justice Department. And then last month, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson criticizes Trump's indictment by the Justice Department and said, quote, leftists are destroying America. Is there evidence of political motivation behind the federal charges against Trump?
No, no. There's no indication I see of a political bias playing a role. And I think that's the key thing, right? I mean, anytime you're talking about an investigation, now prosecutions concerning a prominent political figure, the most prominent political figure, a former president, there's politics in the mix, right? There are political implications, there are political effects. It's going to attract political attention. But the question that I think people really want to ask when they're sort of talking about the making those sorts of comments is there evidence that there was partisan bias that influenced the Justice Department's decision? Maybe even a desire to get a leg up in the 2024 election. I don't see that. And I've reported extensively on Merrick Garland. I wrote a profile about him for Politico early this year. And I think actually it's the claims of Senator Johnson and others are sort of backwards. I mean, the Justice Department did not want to be prosecuting Donald Trump. That was very clear when Biden took office. It was clear to me, given the sort of comments that Merrick Garland said. And it's been provided during confirmation and the like, and it has become increasingly clear with reporting from major media outlets, including a story from the Washington Post that basically concluded that the Justice Department did nothing significant on the 2020 Trump election case until like a year and a half. So, you know, and then the documents case, the raid of Mar-a-Lago and all of the sort of controversy around that, the Justice Department gave Trump many opportunities to provide those documents short of a search. He could have just complied with the subpoena, right? Like all he had to do is comply with the subpoena. There would have been no search of Mar-a-Lago. So, and he didn't comply and in fact, allegedly obstructed the effort to comply with that subpoena. So I think there was a lot of, excited commentary surrounding the search of Mar-a-Lago that I think has not held up well over time at all.
And just to understand here, so there's the special counsel Jack Smith, looking into the sensitive documents found at Mar-a-Lago. But then there in Manhattan, the DA is also, has charges of falsifying business records. So I wonder just like how do the indictments in Manhattan contrast to what's going on with the Mar-a-Lago documents?
Yeah, I mean, I think the indictment it's a very different set of facts.
Okay.
Very different set of facts, right? The facts that are at issue in the criminal case in New York concern Donald Trump's payments to the adult film star Stormy Daniels in the run-up to the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. And the charge is that he falsified business records within the Trump organization that concerned the purpose of that payment, that they were concealed and described internally as payments for legal services, when in fact they were payments to keep Stormy Daniels quiet and payments that continued through, I think, early 2017 or past the election for sure. And so the facts are very different, even though they both involve documents. In terms of sort of the legal parameters of the case, also quite different. I believe the charges at issue in New York, if I remember correctly, have 4-year terms of imprisonment as the maximum possible penalty. But I think most people, myself included, who have some experience in the New York courts, tend to assume that even if he were convicted on that case, it's quite unlikely he would serve a prison term, given the nature of the offense and how New York sort of approaches these cases. Of course, we can't say that definitively, given where we are and what, you know, he hasn't even been convicted yet and all that. But they're quite different in my mind. Okay. And I think the case in New York, and I've written about this too, is legally, I guess I would say, a little more adventurous in terms of the way the prosecutors have used the statutes. And I think Trump has more viable legal defenses and even to some extent factual defenses than he appears to have in the case in Florida.
Ankush Kadori, former federal prosecutor, now contributing editor for New York Magazine, analysis on the wave of criminal and civil legal cases into former President Donald Trump. You can be part of the conversation to ask a question, share your views. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get up to speed on the multiple indictments at the state and federal levels against former President Donald Trump and Trump standing trial in the thick of the 2024 presidential campaign. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ankush Kadori is our guide, contributing editor to New York Magazine, former federal prosecutor. Ankush, we heard from John, called in from Menominee with a question. We'd like to hear about the legal issues regarding the application of the 14th Amendment and how it applies to former President Trump. What are your insights there?
Oh, gosh, good question. So there's been a recent effort on the part of some advocacy groups and some political groups to argue that Donald Trump is ineligible to run for office, constitutionally ineligible, under a provision of the 14th Amendment that prohibits people from holding public office if they engage in insurrection or a rebellion against the United States or aided enemies of the country. And so the argument that many people are making now is that Trump's role in the effort to overturn the 2020 election, role in January 6th, all qualifies as engaging in insurrection, that he's therefore disqualified under the 14th Amendment. I'm not particularly persuaded by this theory, but that's the theory. It has a lot of wrinkles to it historically, very, very limited case law interpreting it. There's now a huge sort of debate that's going on in legal circles about the history and the implications. But I think the short of it for folks listening is that a couple of things would need to happen for this to actually really have some relevance to the 2024 election. People would have to, and some of these cases are underway, but courts would have to conclude that Trump is in fact ineligible on certain states' ballots. And that could then go up to the Supreme Court for them to review. And my own view, just given the way the Supreme Court is currently composed, is that it's quite unlikely that they would disqualify Trump under that theory. But of course, nothing is certain in this area. But that's sort of the general lay of the land.
Well, as we look at constitutional amendments, what about the First Amendment and freedom of speech? If you know, untruthful denial of election results becomes a crime or spreading falsehoods about elections, does that have implications for First Amendment rights?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly a First Amendment issues that are implicated, particularly by the DC case on the 2020 election. And I think prosecutors, though, have done a capable or at least sufficient job of distinguishing simply political speech from the actions that political speech were designed to bring about. And, you know, if you think about like financial fraud, right? Maybe you've gotten a phone call recently from some scammer in some other part of the world who tried to get you to give them their your iCloud password or your Gmail password or some credit card number. That's speech too, right? Mm-hmm. The conduct that, you know, you're being victimized by is speech, but it's criminal, right? Because of the nature of the speech and what it is trying to accomplish. So it's really not enough just to say like that there's speech involved. There are all types of, you know, when someone stops you on the street, God forbid, and says, I got a gun in my pocket, give me your wallet or give me your purse, that's speech too, right? Even if the person doesn't have a gun on them, and it's still a crime. So it's a little subtler than just, you know, there's speech involved. And I think it's, you know, not surprising that Trump's lawyers have seized on it, but like a lot of their arguments, they don't quite, I don't find them terribly compelling.
Let's go to Ross in Soldiers Grove now. Ross, hi.
Hi, good morning. I've been, like many people, reading, and most of my information comes from the newspaper and through the news. And I know that there's a bunch of different cases. There's the New York fraud, the New York, the thing with the tech or the campaign. There's the Mar-a-Lago and the documents. There's the trying to overturn election. And a lot of this gets kind of blurry, but the question I'm kind of wondering about is, he seems like a, and you forgive me because you'll probably detect my bias, but it seems like as if they're like trying to prosecute a mob boss. When I think back of like the name of the mob boss that were ultimately all they got him was on tax fraud, but there was this thought that he had done all this stuff. Is it really going to be about do the prosecutors need, or do they have information that they can say, oh, yeah, we've seen Trump has done this, versus like, well, we have to roll a bunch of his employees to build this case.
Ross, thank you. Ankush, what is your perspective there?
It's a very good question. So I would say that in terms of like the case that has the most, I think, readily accessible, maybe even the most potent, easily understandable facts is the Mar-a-Lago case. And I think particularly, you know, that case charges Trump not with just holding on to those documents, but obstructing the Justice Department's effort to get them back. He does not appear to have particularly good defenses to the obstruction charges. But let me want to say one thing about sort of the concern about like there being so many kind of prosecutors on the scene having descended on Trump at once, because I think a lot of people have that same exact sort of feeling and maybe even anxiety or concern that maybe this is sort of coordinated or it's overreach to some extent. I think about it more like we're in the middle of kind of this very strange constitutional car crash because I think what happened is, if you kind of look at the broad sweep and where the Justice Department was and where the state prosecutors were over the last few years, the Justice Department was not actively investigating Trump for the first year or two of the Biden administration. And so what was happening was that you had these state prosecutors in New York and in Georgia who I think felt like they had a responsibility to their own constituents to pursue conduct that was apparently not being addressed by the Justice Department in their view. But that had occurred within their boundaries. So they move forward with their investigations and ultimately their cases. Meanwhile, the Justice Department sort of belatedly arrives on the scene, in my view, largely, I think, because the January 6th committee sort of shamed them into doing it. But, you know, last November was the appointment of the special counsel. And so all of this stuff sort of collided at once. And I think people are it's a very understandable reaction. Not only the fact that these cases are sort of blurring together, but to really ask, like, how did this happen? Really, what's going on? But that's sort of my assessment.
We're talking about the indictments against former President Trump with Ankush Kadori. He's a lawyer, writer, former federal prosecutor. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Georgia with the racketeering charges. And we saw this week former campaign Trump attorney Kenneth Chesbro becoming one of three co-defendants to plead guilty in the case. What do these guilty pleas mean for the case against Trump in Georgia?
So anytime a defendant in a large multi-defendant case pleads out, it's not good news for the lead defendant, who in this case is Trump, right? Prosecutors want to try to sort of build a wall of evidence in a trial, and each sort of plea deal, each cooperator is like another brick in the wall of evidence. So it's helpful to prosecutors. That said, all of these plea deals were quite favorable. No one is going to serve any prison time. That it's in the low thousands of dollars in terms of fines for each of them. And they pled to fairly discrete types of crimes within the broad ambit of the indictment. So I'll just give you one example. Sidney Powell, her guilty plea appears to have been in connection with an incursion into Georgia's election systems after January 6th. That conduct does not appear, at least based on the public record, to have much connection to Trump himself. So it's not clear that, and the other plea deals have the same sort of structure to them, different sort of very discrete elements of the case that don't necessarily suggest, like they haven't pled guilty to the conspiracy charges. Like nobody has pled guilty to the main charge in the case, which is the RICO conspiracy, right? So here too, we kind of just got to like take it one step at a time. But, you know, this is positive momentum for the prosecutors. It's bad news for Trump. But not quite as bad as I think the press, some people in the press are portraying it at the moment.
In our last minute together, I want to ask you about these gag orders. Yesterday, former President Trump fined $10,000 for violating a gag order. What do you make of them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of controversy with the gag orders, right? In D.C., there's an effort to sort of litigate a gag order that's ongoing. Look, I think what has happened in the New York court in that fraud case seems to be very reasonable in terms of the judge's assessment. I mean, I was quite taken aback by what happened yesterday, even as someone who is, you know, following this stuff for years. I mean, Trump had to take the stand and answer questions about the comments that were at issue yesterday. And he basically lied, I think, on the stand. And that's at least that was the judge's conclusion. And that's what led to the fine. If he keeps it up, they're going to be increasing fines. The dollar amounts are going to go up. Conceivably, there could be imprisonment, although I think that's not really in the proximate future in any of these cases. Yeah, I think the fines are going to go up, and he may actually finally just realize that he should keep his mouth shut. That would be the first time in his life that I think he would come to that conclusion. But this is not helping him, violating this and having to pay all this money.
Ankush, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ankush Kadori is a lawyer in Washington, a contributing editor for New York Magazine, contributing writer for Politico Magazine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the dangers of children on farms sparked by this ProPublica investigation where state and local authorities were horrified by conditions on a Dane County dairy farm and circumstances in the death of an 8-year-old child who was run over by a skid steer in 2019. Call in with questions and concerns about workplace safety in children on farms, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara Lee is a senior research scientist with the National Children's Center for Rural and Agricultural Health and Safety, which is based at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. Barbara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
How typical is the situation that led to Jefferson Rodriguez's death?
It's difficult to say that that's really typical because in Wisconsin, the majority of dairy farms are run and really having their own family children conduct a lot of the work and be in the environment. This situation is, I think, becoming more typical. And what we have to keep in mind is that agriculture in and of itself is one of the most dangerous occupations in the country. And then putting any child into a dangerous work situation can lead to a traumatic event like this.
How common, though, are child injuries or deaths on farms? What does your data tell you?
Well, there's really no official numbers for the United States. We used to get information from the government on injuries and deaths on farms, but those systems no longer collect data. What we know is that on average, there's about 100 deaths on farms across the country, and about 4 of those happen in Wisconsin each year. And what's interesting for us is we see the news, it comes across our desk sometimes on a daily basis. And there's kind of some typical scenarios of what's going on. And it's most surprising to people that about 2/3, and sometimes more than that, of the children who are killed on farms are not working. These are little kids who just happen to be in a very dangerous work situation.
And so what you're saying, though, too, there aren't any numbers on how many children actually are living on these working dairy farms where their parents are working as well.
Correct. The last time the government collected any numbers on that was in 2014. And we know the numbers of farms have gone down. The number of kids and families has gone down.
You know, we often hear these referred to as farm accidents. And I think, you know, I would imagine you want to clarify that because these accidents are preventable. Is that right?
That's right. You know, we in the world of injury prevention do not use the word accident. We think that that really implies it's an act of God. It's not preventable, but we know that injuries and injury events are very predictable and preventable. And if you look at the automobile industry, they eliminated using the word accident more than 20 years ago. So we really prefer that people call it what it is. It's an injury event. It might be a tractor crash, some kind of a crushing and machinery event, but it's definitely not an accident. And honestly, we kind of go nuts when people use the word freak accident because these things we see repeatedly. They just are not that rare.
When you discuss typical scenarios. What are some things that seem to come up over and over? Is it the machinery on the farm? Is it something else? Is it the cattle? What are these encounters like?
Well, I've been reading these news clippings and hearing stories for over 30 years. And if you ask me, the typical, the most common is a father or a grandfather taking a young child on a tractor. They're an extra rider on the tractor, or it's a joyride, or they're there because they don't have any other childcare. And something happens, you know, the tractor hits a bump, it hits a curb, ditch, and the child falls out, is run over. And even a tractor cab is not a safe place for a child.
Let's take a call now. Dan is joining us from St. Croix County. Dan, hi.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I'll tell you that I am not a farmer, but I am involved with county government. I'm a county supervisor in St. Croix County. And I do work with dairy farmers in many aspects, and I'm concerned with regulation in some ways. I do not mean to minimize in any way the tragedy that this family has had happen to them, but I'm also concerned with the ability of farmers to do business and exist. We have so many dairy farmers who are suffering financially because of the fluctuations in market. Just because we see prices going up in the grocery stores, farmers don't see additional profits. So if regulation is the answer, and I think this should be said, that also regulation should include protections for the farmers, that farmers themselves shouldn't bear the cost of additional protections, because in not only people who come from other countries to work on our farms are hurt, people who belong to farm families are also injured in farm accidents.
Dan, you bring up such important points, and I want to have Barbara respond here as you look at those safety regulations. They come with a cost, Barbara, and can eat into potential profits, as Dan points out.
Right. I think you bring up a good point about what is the role of public policy and regulations. And in the case of Jefferson, I think a lot of different systems failed. He wasn't in school. The farm wasn't necessarily up to safety standards. The equipment wasn't safe. But it's not always that regulations are going to help in that area. We really think that in terms of children and farming, it's a tough call, you know. People want to farm, they want to have kids, but we really believe that we have to set the priorities of where are the children when the work is going on, and can I afford to be a farmer and a parent at the same time? So systems like better childcare, better access to safety, personal protective equipment, and general kind of safety training and support for improving the overall safety of a farm is really important.
And you also have to think about the logistics, improve childcare, and yet there are so many childcare deserts. And on a farm in a rural area, it might be miles and miles away to the nearest childcare provider if they can get a slot.
I agree. And that's a big issue that we're trying to work on now, is finding public support for better childcare services so that parents, if they do want to work full time on the farm, they have some options where their children are going to be. Certainly during the school year, it helps, you know, if they've got school aged kids. But other than that, during the summer, during breaks, and especially for the little tykes, if they don't have off farm childcare, you're put into a situation where you're trying to get the work done while you're watching the kids, and it puts both in jeopardy because you're less productive at work and your child may be put in harm's way.
There are children working on farms and children living on them. When you look at these injuries, is one group of children more at risk?
Definitely. The numbers would show that it's the little children, 7 and under. Just in Wisconsin, in the last few years, most of the children who were killed were like 2 years old or 4 years old. Again, these are people who are not contributing to the work, and they should just be in a better place. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to acknowledge that farming is a wonderful place for kids to grow up. Parents want their kids to get acquainted with the farm environment. And the question is, how can they do that safely so that a child who has that great opportunity to grow up on a farm also has a chance to be healthy and safe and enjoy the best that farming can give them?
I see the tractor ride there is coming to mind, and just giving that child what it is like, something that perhaps that mother or father also had at their age. And I think what you're trying to say here is safety first. You really have to look that this is machinery, and there could be a lot of risks involved for a young child.
Absolutely. And the tractor is a perfect example of an old tradition that has to change. And we say it's easier to bury a tradition than a child.
Talking about farm safety with Barbara Lee, a Wisconsin scientist based at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. You can join in with your questions, your insights and experiences, 800-642-1234. Barbara, something that hasn't come up in our conversation is how often children are injured by toxins, toxic fertilizers or pesticides, chemicals on the farm that are used on the fields, on the crops.
So that's a good question, and we really don't have good data to tell us about that. There's no required reporting of it, and it typically turns out to be a more chronic problem for them. So they're not going to the emergency room where we might be able to count the numbers. The other thing to keep in mind is the packaging of a lot of these chemicals is much better, it's stronger, and they're used in different ways than, you know, when I first started, we had a lot of kids that would ingest dairy pipeline cleaner because it looked like water. These types of cleaning systems and cleaning fluids are now locked up and packaged such that little kids rarely can get access to them.
How should they be? How should they be on the farm in terms of locked up or in separate areas, or how do you see them being used in terms of on the farm and put away in a place that can't be accessed unless by an adult?
Well, I suppose you could think of it like a loaded firearm. You know, how do you keep that away from children so that they don't have access to it? And then you limit the number of people who actually do have access to chemicals such as that.
Barbara Lee is director of the National Children's Center for Rural and Agricultural Health and Safety based at Marshfield Clinic here in Wisconsin. Bring your questions, your comments about farming operations and the safety concerns for children. What's coming up for you? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. ProPublica continues to investigate safety concerns on dairy farms in Wisconsin and the Midwest. We look at next steps for how to improve workplace safety, especially when children are around these operations. Still time to surface questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Barbara Lee is Senior Research Scientist at the National Children's Center for Rural and Agricultural Health and Safety. Let's bring in Tom in Watertown. Hi, Tom. What would you like to convey?
Well, I grew up on a farm, and the kids grew up on a farm, and I've worked on it since, actually, I was in the barn before I was even in grade school. And our kids have been, we took our kids to all the farmer safety stuff and the tractor safety. They went through the course, and I'm all for safety, but we can't just lock our kids in either. I probably learned more helping my dad and stuff on a farm than and I think the main thing here is when you're doing your work and you got a kid along, you got to slow her down about 3-4 gears. You can't be, you know, just take it slow.
Be slow and deliberate. Yes. Tom, I want to ask Barbara here to join in on what is your reaction to Tom's story?
Well, Tom, it's very typical. And we hear this a lot from people, you know, the traditions that have been passed along and the things that kids have done. And I commend you for your participation in the safety events and certainly for considering that working with children, you need to take a different approach, go much slower and a lot more supervision and that type of thing. So I think the first thing we think about is having the farm safe for the adult workers so that the equipment is up to standards and you have safe protocols and policies in terms of who can do what by when, and then get the kids involved when they're ready, physically, emotionally, socially, to take on different types of activities. So I think there are good things that happen. We know there's great things that happen when kids can grow up on a farm, but let's just be wise about when they're involved and how they're involved.
Tom brings up farm safety courses, tractor safety courses. How accessible are these across Wisconsin?
Well, unfortunately, they're less accessible than they used to be. Part of that is funding, part of that is demand. So we do have a number of resources online available. Our own center has a website, cultivatesafety.org, that has multiple guidelines for children's work, different types of work, guidelines for developing safe play areas on farms, and a lot of information that way. There's also Safety Day events that go on, and then certainly the tractor certification course that the state tries to provide when they can, that is for kids starting at the age of 12.
What might a safe play area on a farm be like?
Well, just imagine a yard next to the house.
Yes.
That has a fence, a nice fenced-in area, and we recommend that you have use some of the farming things like a calf hutch or a tire for a sand box, little play areas, and certainly an important part is a place for the adults to sit. So there can be adult maybe sitting and folding laundry or something outside on the picnic table while the kids are playing in that enclosed area. The biggest recommendation we always have is a physical barrier between the child and the dangerous work area or the driveway.
And so staying in that area and having that adult present really helpful there, that separates maybe the other barns on the property and the fields and in other areas where the work is underway.
Right. And you know what? In that play area, you can have your toy tractors, your trucks, you know, your skid steers and your ATVs, your all your fun little things that make you feel close to the farm environment without being exposed to the hazards.
I want to turn to federal regulations on the farm. Family farms, they're exempt from child labor restrictions that are enforced by federal authorities. And so children of any age can work on the farm. No restrictions on the number of hours they work. Should there be tighter regulations here?
I'm not sure that that's possible to do that. We would like to see definitely the list of hazardous occupation orders updated that shows for kids working in other industries, such as operating machinery or handling chemicals. We think that those ages should be the same, whether you're in agriculture or construction or mining. But in terms of regulations for kids working on family farms, I just don't see that happening because it would just be extremely hard to enforce. However, the one thing that I think we've been remiss on is following up with legal consequences for when there's unsafe or reckless behavior. And we know that in a number of cases where a child dies, people are just goofing off or somebody is intoxicated and taking a child for a joyride on a tractor. In those types of cases, I think it's important that the legal system does get involved and look at, is this some kind of gross negligence or reckless endangerment of the child? And then follow up in order to really ensure that that farm does not become the site of future tragedies for kids.
Talking about farm safety with Barbara Lee, Wisconsin scientist at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. Still time to join in at 800-642-1234. Barbara, the New York Times reported how migrant children are often working really treacherous jobs in our country, including many agricultural jobs. Could more enforcement of existing child labor laws help protect children on farms?
Certainly, if they are hired children and doing seasonal work, definitely the regulations should be looking at what are the jobs these kids are doing, making sure they're not exposed to pesticides or heavy machinery, this type of thing. And then really looking at the hours of work so that we don't have kids, you know, as young as 12 working 14 or 16 hour days.
You know, research institutes like yours are often guided by really good data. And it sounds like in this particular area, there's a good bit of murky data and that you're really charged with having to find that with the absence of some sound federal data. You know, how do you know what to focus on in the absence of really good numbers at a research institute?
It's a good question. We really do depend on stories from people, and our center collects news clippings. We have the largest collection of publicly available news. It's in a database, and this captures all of the states in our country, and we rely on that to show us trends. So, for example, we talk about Jefferson, the Nicaraguan boy who was run over by a skid steer. And that's a trend that we see is really growing, that the increased use of those skid steers, because they're kind of like small tractors, they're used by young people and they're used more often and around the clock. And little kids are just not visible when a skid steer is moving quickly in and around a barn. So we rely on the news, we rely on our colleagues across the country to highlight what are the big issues.
Barbara, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Barbara Lee is a research scientist, senior research scientist at the National Children's Center for Rural and Agricultural Health and Safety, which is based at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.